Okay, welcome back to the fourth week lectures of the time series, applied time series analysis course. And this, during this lecture, we are going to be discussing about the more like the real life examples of the GARCH models. And I, as I already mentioned yesterday, these are probably the ones that you, most of you, will be needing in one form or another when you start, for example, doing your master's thesis or in your practical professional work when you go to the markets. Because most of the guys working in analytics, for example, in banking firms or these kind of institutional investors are actually familiar with these kind of models quite well. The main purpose of these models is basically to help in forecasting the volatility or the riskiness of the assets. So here is a very standard textbook example of the Day and Lewis paper that was originally published in Journal of Econometrics. So this is one of the examples of the journals that are very heavy duty journals in terms of statistical theory and statistical methods or econometric methods that are being presented there, because in most of the cases the original papers for some new methods, for example, appear in these kind of journals like Journal of Econometrics or Econometrica or Journal of Business and Economic Statistics. So these are so-called heavy-duty journals. But lots of these procedures that I will be also discussing today, for example, you can get a more like a practical point of view or from an applied econometrician's point of view of using these models from other journals that are less heavy in terms of statistical theory. So don't be panicked about these original papers or the methods or the mathematical derivations that we'll be going shortly through here. Pay more attention to the papers that are applying these models. For example, regarding the so-called dynamic conditional correlation GARCH models that are very relevant in nowadays analysis, especially for the most recent data, because after the global financial crisis, we have seen that the correlations and covariances between the asset returns in almost every kind of funds and market segments have changed quite a lot. The things that have been working before the global financial crisis are not working after that. So basically one good example of these is the so-called covered interest parity condition. And then nice paper about that is the paper by Du, Tepperen, and Vertelhan, given in Journal Finance 2018. Probably Heikki will be discussing about that paper in the International Finance course. So that gives a nice example about the complete collapse of covered interest rate parity after the global financial crisis. And one of the possibilities to apply or model these changes in the correlations between the variables, in that case, changes in the correlation between interest yielding assets and exchange rates, are one of the possibilities is to use these kind of, for example, GARCH models, or as a more advantage or more advantageous application of those DCC GARCH models. I will be discussing shortly one of my most recent papers that has also applied that method at the end of this lecture. But let's now first focus on this very fundamental paper of Day and Lewis. They just wanted to analyze whether these GARCH models are good for forecasting purposes. So they want to predict the future stock index volatility, the very near term, the one step ahead volatility. So the main question here is that, is it actually relevant to use the past information from the realized volatilities? Which means that in that case, you would be modeling in a parametric way in a model for the returns the variance of the returns using a Garch model, some form of Garch model. They basically try two forms of Garch models here, Garch and eGarch, which is an asymmetric version of the Garch models. So they are using weekly closing prices. So basically, they have daily prices at the start of the analysis, but they calculate the weekly prices from the daily prices. And they are analyzing Wednesday to Wednesday returns and also Friday to Friday returns. Here in our example, we are not focusing on the Friday to Friday returns actually at all, because it actually was after that, this paper, it has been found actually that in a daily data for stock market prices, the actual volatility, so for some reason or other, seem to be increasing towards the end of the week. So the Friday to Friday returns at the weekly level might actually contain something that is actually disturbing the Garch process. They might have kind of a seasonal effect, but you have basically no explanation for that. Why is it the case? So they do the analysis for the S&P 100 index option for the period of 11th of March in 83 until the end of December in 1998. And they use the implied volatility as the sort of a comparison point. Why can you use implied volatility here? Or what is the purpose of using implied volatility here? The main idea there is that actually when you use the implied volatility, you have a certain set of information from the markets that you should be able to utilize in calculating the implied volatility. Those of you that have not taken the derivatives course that is being taught by Juhani Raatikainen here in our university, take a look at, for example, the very standard textbook by Bode, Kane and Marcus titled Investments. I think that the latest edition, 11th edition is from 2020 actually. It's a huge book about finance in general. There's also a good chapter describing the modeling of stock options. So take a look at from that one for the case of Black-Scholes model. Johan will be using mainly the book by Hull. That is also a very good book that gives a very thorough description of options, futures, and other derivatives in financial markets. But nevertheless, the main idea in the Black-Scholes model is, as we discussed already yesterday, that you have some information about the pricing of stock options. First of all, you can observe from the markets the call option price of those options, then the stock price and exercise price, and you have idea about the time to expiration of the stock option, and then you have some measure for the risk-free interest rate. So there are lots of information that you can directly observe from the markets. These are all things that get to be reported, for example, in Financial Times and in online sources for information, for example, in DataStream. But the implied volatility, if it gets to be reported there, then it has to be calculated based on some kind of model. And the Black-Scholes model is the one that you can, for example, use for the calculation of implied volatility after you have gathered all the other relevant information that you get from the market. And here it is mentioned, take a look at that original paper if you want to familiarize yourself more about the calculation of the implied volatility. But you can use, for example, Newton-Raphson type iterative procedure to calculate the implied volatilities. You will be calculating these actually in the Johannes course. And also you can calculate them self by using those textbook examples. But the main idea in terms of testing the working of, for example, Black-Scholes models for option pricing in view of the Garch models is that if that model is working, then basically the implied volatility should be very close to the actual volatility that you observe in the markets. So you should be able to forecast the future next step volatility based on the calculated implied volatility. And if there is a role for Gartsch models, then basically it gives you information about the efficiency of the markets. Because in that case, actually, it's the case that the past history of the actual volatilities based on Gartsch model for the returns and the variance of the returns is useful in forecasting the near step first one step values for the volatility. So basically the utilization of Gartsch models or analysis of Gartsch models here is a test for market efficiency. Are the markets performing in view of some underlying theoretical model? So the base models that they are focusing here are actually of this kind of model. So basically they are actually using the variance, conditional variance, as the thing here in the mean equation. So they are considering the excess returns for the market portfolio that they define to be the S&P 100 index. So this is the, for the excess returns. So they have a model for the excess returns for S&P 500 because this is the risk-free interest rate. It's kind of a plain vanilla model. So basically you have only a constant term here and then the information from the conditional volatility. And for the variance, they are imposing a Gartsch 1-1 as the first possibility. Why is this Gartsch 1-1? Can anyone tell me from the yesterday's lectures? Why is this denoted to be a Gartsch 1-1 model? If this were to be an arch one model, then only the past squared observations of residuals would be used as the explanatory variables here in the definition for this. Is very much a deterministic representation for the variance. And but now that we are using also the past value, so this resembles an AR type representation. But this is not a stochastic equation. It's a deterministic equation. We don't have any error terms here in the variance equation at all. So basically, we have the past information of the conditional variance from the previous period included here. So that's why this model is a Gartsch 1-1. The additional or the alternative model is based on this exponential Nelson type asymmetric Gartsch model that we discussed yesterday that gives some kind of role for the previous sign of the previous observations, sign of the previous observation for the UT term in the mean equation. So this is the alternative. So they're testing for the relevance of the Gartsch 1-1 model against the relevance of the exponential Nelson type Gartsch model, which is here the equation 3. So RMT here is the return on market portfolio and RFT here is the risk-free interest rate. And here HT denotes the conditional variance from the two Gartsch type models that they are using. And they use this denotation or notation for the implied variance from the option prices that is being calculated based on the Newton-Raphson method using the Black-Scholes model. Take a look at the standard textbooks if you have no idea for the Black-Scholes model right now, and in Johannes course you will be also taught that. But this is sort of an additional conditioning information in the forecasting equation for the variance. So they have calculated this based on the Black-Scholes model, so they can input that as an additional variable to the data generating process of the variance when they are testing the relevance of this model. So in when they test for the role of implied volatility in the modeling of conditional volatility of excess returns for the market portfolio, they introduce these past values of the implied volatility. And the main idea is basically about testing for the relevance of these parameter estimates. Are they statistically significantly different from zero or not? Because basically, this is now a forecasting equation. So you can forecast also the future one step ahead values for the conditional variance when you have observation from current period for the UT and observation from current period for the HT and from for the current period implied volatility. So you can use this as a one step ahead forecast model, assuming that the parameter estimates stay the same. And in this case, when you are interested about whether the implied volatility term here, this guy here, is important in the exponential graph representation, then they input that into the equation for the conditional variance in the exponential graphs representation. Don't get panicked about these parametric representations of the model. They don't look very nice, but the same ideas apply here. This is a Gauss representation basically, but the role of the arch term gets to be accounted by also taking into account the sign of the previous residual. And in terms of these leverage effects or this asymmetric behavior we imposed yesterday, that perhaps it might be the case that if we have negative residuals, they have more effect on the volatility than do the positive residuals. That is just for a parameterization using the Nelson's model ideas. And these are the representations that we are considering for the GARCH model, and the role of this additional information based on the stock option model, pricing of stock options based on Black-Scholes ideas is taken into account in the here. So we are testing, first of all, whether the implied volatility, the theoretically implied calculated volatility, has a role to play in the conditional variance equation or not. And in addition, we obviously also always want to test whether the GARCH representation is valid, whether these parameter estimates are valid or not, and also in this exponential representation of the GARCH model, whether beta 1 is valid, statistically different from 0, whether alpha 0 is statistically different from 0, and all these other things also. So basically, if the second set of restrictions holds for GARCH modeling, so if there is no role for past history of conditional variance in forecasting the future values of the conditional variance, then basically only thing that is relevant for the variance or the volatility is then this implied volatility. And in case of the second representation, so basically we have this possibility also once again that it's only this implied volatility. So these equations for Newton or this exponential GARCH and for the second representation, they actually end up into these very simple tests for the relevance of implied volatility, assuming that either GARCH 1-1 or the exponential GARCH is a relevant model. So basically, this is about testing for the working of the Black-Scholes models. So is it useful to use the implied volatility to the forecast equation for the variance or the volatility? Or are the markets actually kind of inefficient in a way that modeling in a parametric representation, the conditional volatility of the excess returns for S&P 100 is relevant? So the GARCH models have statistical significance parameters in those the parameter estimates. It is actually a test for a market inefficiency. So So we can test for all these restrictions because we are using maximum likelihood estimation, as we yesterday pointed out. Then we can use a likelihood ratio test for all of these tests regarding the information that we are using in the conditional vulnerability model. So here are the in-sample likelihood ratio tests. In-sample means that we are not now forecasting out of samples. We are not doing the one-step ahead forecast yet here and compare those to the actual volatilities that we always observe from the markets. We are not doing that here. We are just estimating now the in-sample estimations for the GARCH and introducing the role of implied volatility. So what can you say about GARCH representation? Here we have the mean equation. First of all, we have T ratios here in parentheses. So what do you think based on the parameter estimates for each and every one? Do we have a GARCH 1-1 model here in question? And in addition, does the implied volatility have any kind of role there in statistical terms? Take a look at the parameter estimates. So here we have the GARCH 1-1 representation. Is, first of all, the conditional volatility, is it relevant in the mean equation at all? How can you take the inference regarding that idea of the null hypothesis? Which of the parameter estimates here is referring to the information, role of the information in the conditional volatility series?
Is it the lambda one?
Yeah, it's the lambda one. So is it, if we have T ratios in parentheses, is lambda one significant in?
It is.
We have T ratios here.
Sorry, no, 10%.
Yeah, no, it's not significant at all because we have T ratio. We don't have standard errors here. So T ratio, the critical value at 5%. So 5% significance level, the critical value for T ratio is 1.96, around that, for positive parameter estimates, and minus 1.96 for negative parameter estimates. So do we have significance there at all?
No.
Basically, it doesn't seem to be. But is some kind of ARCH model, is it actually relevant here? GARCH model, is it relevant here? Is any of the GARCH parameters, is any of the GARCH parameters in any of the equations, is it statistically significant or not? Take a look at T ratios. They are reported here in parentheses and compare the reported values there to the value of 1.96 at 5% significance level. I'm pointing out the one that seems to be relevant. So basically a GARCH 1-1 representation in the equation where we don't have the implied volatility included seems to be relevant. But what if we include the implied volatility? If we include the implied volatility, then we are focusing on this parameter estimate here. So it is being reported in the case where we augment the GARCH1 representation with the implied volatility. And basically in 8.81 knot, we are actually testing for the single role of implied volatility. So skipping the GARCH model completely. So what can you say about the role of implied volatility? The role of implied volatility would seem to be highly essential here actually, because in the GARCH model where we include it, so it's referring to this equation 8.81, implied volatility gets to be statistically significantly estimated. Its t ratio is it's 3, but all the other, or the actually the GARCH parameter estimates get to be not statistically significant except for the constant term in the GARCH equation. The constant term is equally statistically significant than is basically the implied volatility term. And if we skip all information here in the actual GARCH1 part and only use the implied volatility series that we can really calculate from the data that we have, past values of that are being used in the conditional volatility equation. So we estimate the maximum likelihood estimation. Together with this, we impose a structure for the conditional volatility. So this guy here is behaving based on these. So when we square the value of the H parameter here, then basically this is wrong here. This, you don't, should not have this to the power of 2, because we are just including here. This is the same as here, HT all the time. There's an error here because the original paper uses H to the power of 2 as the notation for the volatility, and this is from the original paper, so it's an error here. We are modeling the heteroscedasticity, or we are modeling the variance here, but notations, the usual textbook notation is this HT, but the guys in that paper, they and Lewis, actually are using this H to the power 2. So basically this is the same equation, but we are skipping the GARCH part here. What can you say about these models in terms of taking a look at the log likelihood value? So basically, which one of the models is the best? Log L denotes the maximized value of the log likelihood function in each case. So which model is the best? Where you get the maximum value for this log likelihood. And the maximum value is being observed here in the biggest case of the biggest model. So basically it seems to be actually that GARCH1 perhaps could be something, but the individual GARCH parameter estimates alpha 1 and beta 1 are not statistically significantly different from 0, but the constant term is relevant there. But more importantly, the implied volatility is relevant. The alternative is this asymmetric version for the GARCH representation. So take a quick look at these parameter estimates here. So this is once again equation for variance specification. There are some letters missing there because this copy pasted from the, actually from the Brooks book, this table. So what can you say about in terms of the validity of the exponential GARCH model and in terms of the role of the implied volatility? Is exponential GARCH useful at all? Basically, based on this C row here, it would seem to be the case that because these T statistics here are clearly above 1.96, basically the Karch term here, the lacked conditional heteroskedastic, this is also, there's also a typo here, the lacked conditional heteroskedasticity would seem to be statistically important, statistically significant. Also, the theta parameter estimate, so the parameter for the asymmetriness, so for the leverage effect, it seems to be also statistically relevant or significant, and also this gamma parameter here. So exponential Karch is actually, without any additional information from the implied volatility series, it seems to be a relevant representation actually, because the parameter estimates for the Karch model here are actually statistically significant. And here also the constant term is statistically significant. So what about the role of implied volatility? What can you say about that?
It seems to be significant.
Yeah, it seems to be significant as itself. So when we ignore the Karch part completely, once again, the implied volatility is clearly, it's significant here. Also in the eGARCH representation of the data, but actually it seems to be the case that here this asymmetric effect that is being reflected by the size of the theta parameter here, that is actually also statistically significant. So in many ways, actually, it seems to be the case that we have an asymmetric representation for the conditional volatility of the excess returns of S&P 100 index portfolio, but the implied volatility based on the Black-Scholes model is actually also relevant, but here only at the 10% statistical significance level actually. So it's now very much about the role of implied volatility here. We do get a role for the asymmetric effects in the Karch representation, but that sort of wipes out the statistical significance of the implied volatility, at least partly. It's not so statistically significant anymore. This is only significant at 10% level, actually, if you take a look at the tables, statistical t-tables, but the implied volatility, when we skip all the information in the eGARCH representation of the volatility, the implied volatility stays there. So it has a role. But once again, this big model, this highly parameterized model in terms of the maximization of the log likelihood function in the maximum likelihood estimation, it's actually giving you a result that you should use that one. But this usually is the case, the more you have parameters in the estimated model. So basically, it should be something. So is this useful? The main of the question, one of the main question, the main question in the whole research is that, is this useful for forecasting? Can you forecast the future behavior of volatility better using this model or not? Or is it just enough that you calculate based on the data that you now observe from the markets, you calculate the near term, the one step ahead volatility for the excess returns based on the implied volatility that you get from the markets? So it seems that in sample estimations, basically we have a situation where implied volatility has a role to do. It has extra incremental power for modeling stock volatility beyond Karch. But these are in sample tests, so they are not about the forecasting performance of the model at all. So the next step is to conduct a real life out of sample forecasting exercise. And this is the standard way to do. So you use a subsample of your actual observations to do the estimations, and then do step by step addition of the observations and always forecast one step ahead. So you get the forecasted value based on your regression model and then compare that forecasted value to the actual value. And in this case, for the volatility of the stock returns. So they have the total observation, number of observations is 729, and they decide for some reason or other, they don't give any specific reasons why they just want to use these first 410 observations. Usually we sort of do these subsample estimations based on, for example, idea that the data before something happens in the market is the one that we use for the in-sample estimation, and then try to forecast whether after that shock in the market, shock evening in the market, you are able to still forecast using the same model during the shocked period. For example, global financial crisis is a very good example about these kind of shock divisions of the data. So now they use first 410 observations and estimate the model and then make one step ahead forecasts of the following week's volatility. They roll over the sample, so they actually do this recursively to be exact, because they always include or increase the number of observations by one. So they take one weekly observation and then do the estimations and once again forecast for 1 week ahead, then add once again 1 week of observations and observation, and then forecast 1 week ahead. So this is basically a recursive forecasting exercise, not a rolling forecasting exercise. Rolling would be keeping the sample size always the same. So you would be changing the start of the sample by one step and the end of the sample always by one step. So the sample size stays the same, 410 in this actually. That is a rolling forecasting sample. But they are using actually a recursive sampling here. So the simple idea of testing for the accuracy of the forecasts would be after you have generated the forecasted values here, FT, so you have a series for one step ahead forecasts. And then you have obviously also somehow calculated the actual volatility for one step ahead. So if you do an auxiliary regression for this, then you are able to test for the accuracy of the forecasts. So basically, if you have a very good forecast series, then it should be basically producing almost the same values for the forecast 1 period ahead forecasts as are the actual 1 period ahead observations. So these are the 1 period ahead observations, and these are the 1 period ahead forecasts. So when you do a regression where you regress the actual future one-step observations against the forecast, it should be the case that if we have a perfectly accurate forecast series, then the constant term here should obviously be zero, and the coefficient on these forecast values should be statistically not different from one. So one of the main questions when you do these kind of exercises is that how do you measure, for example, in this case, the volatility? What is the true value? So what is this? How do you calculate this series on the left-hand side of this additional regression? And they use two measures. So they use the square of the weekly return on the index, which they call the squared volatility, squared return volatility. The other possibility takes into account the variation in the daily returns at the weekly observations. So variance of that considered week's daily returns multiplied by the number of trading days. And this can obviously vary a bit. Usually it's 5 trading days, but if you have, for example, 7 days of observations for, like, for example, currencies, you might have, but in this case, it's usually 5, excluding the holiday days, when you have only four observations or even three observations, like for Christmas holidays, for example. But this is actually something that has been criticized in these GARCH models when you do these forecast performance analysis, that you actually would have to take into account, for example, when you calculate daily returns, you would have to take into account that the within day, so like 10 minutes or hourly variations in the prices might actually be very relevant to take into account in the daily observations. And we have now that we have seen during the last couple of weeks these discussions about the role of social media in launching kind of a hyper reactions in the stock markets, like for example, actually the case for a Nokia stock also. It was under highly speculative behavior in the US markets, and its return actually increased quite a lot, especially the within day volatility in Nokia prices and Nokia returns was huge in some days. So it might be actually during the extreme volatile periods of stock returns, it might be very relevant thing to take into account. So this is perhaps a more like real life or more exact measure for the actual volatility at weekly level when you take into account the volatility at the daily observations, because the original data is daily observations. You basically can also take into account that. So when you do this kind of volatility analysis, once again, be very careful by digging deeper the behavior of the data originally. How do the prices behave at the daily level? And how do the volatilities behave at the daily level? And then start doing the calculations, taking into account perhaps these things in a more careful way. But nevertheless, they calculate these two measures for this left-hand side variable in this auxiliary regression number 7. So they use the historic volatility in two ways. This is the weekly average value of the daily returns or daily volatility, and this is for that simple measure based on this square of the weekly return index, original weekly return index. So what can you say about the accuracy of the forecasting models? So basically this is actually kind of an AR representation when you are using here as the relevant forecast the past observation of or the current observation of the historic volatility. You use that as the information and then forecast the future one step ahead. So would it seem to be the case that an AR model is actually quite good or not?
It's pretty good.
What can you say about any of the other, which one of the other possible representations for the forecasted variable would be, or the forecasted series would be perhaps the best one?
I think the first two.
So you think the forecasted, these are actual, so this is basically not a forecasted, this is the past observation of the left-hand side variable basically here, and you use that for forecasting the future. So information about the historical volatility up until point T is being used here in the first two cases, and you forecast the future next observation using that. And compare that to the actual future forecast value So basically you are doing that in here. And this results actually fairly good results. So AR1 model might be actually a relevant thing here. But what about these Karch representations? Which of these ones would seem, in terms of auto sample performance, perhaps the best one? So you consider the cases from the third until the last one here, eighth one here, considering always a bit different calculation for the realized volatility, the left-hand side variable here. Just taking a look at the value for the parameter estimate, not just about its statistical significance. If you are focusing on the goodness of the forecast values, then this guy here should be actually close to one. In this case, when you have Karch and you have calculated the historic volatility based on this daily observations, or the average of the daily observations at the weekly level. So basically this results into a situation where the coefficient beta 1 or B1 is very close to 1. This is not for the T statistics is not reported here for the null hypothesis of 1 for B1, but it's for the null hypothesis of B being 0. But nevertheless, it seems to be the case actually that the series are very good proxies for future actual observations in this case. The interesting result here is that even though in in-sample exercise or in-sample regressions, the implied volatility was the one that seemed to be actually the most relevant information, it more or less wiped out the role of Karch parameters. In out-of-sample comparisons, actually, it doesn't perform so well. These are very far from the value of one. Actually, you get much closer values to one in case of Karch models, also in exponential Karch representation for these simple returns, so simple volatility of the actual historical volatility. But these guys are very far from the value of one. And they even, this guy, in the last case here, we have that implied volatility is actually forecast parameter estimate for the implied volatility is actually approaching one, but it's not even near to the values that we get in the Karch models. So this is actually now a very good example, and this is one of the reasons why this almost 30 years old paper is still now being referred when you want to discuss the goodness of the forecasting ability of the Karch models. So basically it is very actually much able to forecast in out of sample in a very near term context. So what if you include all these various possibilities for the forecasting variables to a encompassing model? So include all the possible things here. The first one here is referring, so you are once again forecasting the one step ahead values. You are using in this regression also the constant term, but more importantly, you are imposing now the current observations of implied volatility, current observations of Karch volatility, current observations of exponential Karch volatility, and current observations of historical volatility. So you are basically now doing kind of an encompassing test for the role of this implied volatility. So in the first case, you compare whether the implied volatility is relevant and the Karch volatility is relevant. So once again, you have these ratios in parentheses. So just take a look at the significance of the parameter estimates. Which of these models might seem to be performing the best? What does this reveal, actually, first of all, about the role of implied volatility? Is it relevant in out of sample forecast exercise at all? Implied volatility is this IT case here. So its parameter estimates is B1. Is it relevant in any of these cases?
No,
it's not. So what about then when you start to figure out which one of the CARS representations might be producing more relevant forecasts for a future volatility? Is it GARCH or is it eGARCH? Take a quick look at all the models that involve the parameter estimate on GARCH and the parameter estimate on eGARCH. So this is for GARCH 1.1 and this is for the eGARCH one.
Is it the GARCH?
Yeah. And why is it?
Because that T ratio is 2.78.
Yeah, in this case where we are comparing GARCH against eGARCH. eGARCH forecasts have basically no role, but GARCH forecasts do. And actually this is actually quite nice that even the parameter estimate for the GARCH forecast is very close to one actually here. So it would seem to be the case that the interesting result here is that in terms of out-of-sample performance, even though in-sample estimations, the implied volatility was very relevant, in out-of-sample exercise, it's not. So basically B1 here doesn't get to be statistically significantly estimated in any of these cases. But GARCH forecasts get a statistically significant parameter estimate with a value close to one. So this is actually one of the good examples that GARCH modeling might be relevant, but you actually here see also one of the very good examples why we so much discuss about the possibility of using ARMA GARCH models. Because for example, here in the representation or the testing for the goodness of the past history of the actual volatility, we actually get the result that the historical volatility is very good in forecasting the future. So the volatility seems to be in this observation, set of observations, fairly stable thing actually, at least for this subsample. So you are able to use the historical volatility to forecast the future actually very well. Basically these other guys, implied volatility or the GARCH volatility, when you include the historical volatility, they get to be wiped out. So when you include the historical volatility forecasts, the forecasts based on implied volatility and GARCH model, actually GARCH 1.1, they get to be wiped out. So they don't have a role to play there. So basically we are in a situation here that we have some information that GARCH might be relevant here. So actually we are now, perhaps we could use for also longer run forecasting exercises this GARCH model. So within sample results simply suggest that the implied volatility contains extra information not contained in the GARCH and exponential GARCH specifications, but out of sample results give you, perhaps you should not conclude so harshly against the GARCH models because this is based on the simple finding here that the R squared values here for this forecast regression equation, they are really poor. So only even in the best case where you actually have the case where you have the historical volatility, actually as the main important variable there explaining behavior of the actual future one step ahead observations, you only have 3.8% of the variation in the future one step volatility to be explained by all these things. So this is the reason why you basically conclude that auto sample forecasting is very difficult using these GARCH models. But because most of the information is being already captured in the actual historical volatility of the price or the returns, of excess returns. So basically this nothing additional information can not basically be very much of use. But if you were here to decide of which of the representations in the GARCH modeling you would be interested in using, then basically you would be making a decision that perhaps you should use this GARCH. Even though it's resulting to the poorest performance in terms of this R squared value for this forecasting equation. So perhaps GARCH is useful, but obviously there are lots of things that might be actually skipped out or left out from this kind of forecasting exercises. So basically when we were talking about this implied volatility models, or using, for example, Black-Scholes models to calculate the implied volatility of the stock returns based on the option values, then basically we are discussing, in mathematical terms, we are discussing something that is actually referring to stochastic volatility models. So when you're using these kind of GARCH representations of the data, basically you are only focusing into a situation where you don't have stochasticity in this actual GARCH representation. So this is like a deterministic representation that you have to take into account when you estimate this excess return equation by at the same time imposing a parametric representation for this guy here. So this obviously gives you an idea that this is very much a non-linear in parameters, this model, but there's no stochasticity in this. So this is a deterministic representation for the variance. We don't have an error term here. We assume that this is the exact representation for the variance or the conditional variance. And actually in these Black-Scholes models, for example, it's actually the case that we are using kind of a stochastic volatility models for that. So stochastic volatility models differ from GARCH in that the conditional variance equation of GARCH specification is completely deterministic because it doesn't include an error term. So it's not a regression equation actually, even though we are testing for the significance of the parameter estimates, but basically the significance of the parameter estimates gets to be considered in view of the mean equation. We are imposing the parameter representation for the valid information in the mean equation for the conditional volatility. So it's not a regression equation basically. So there is no error term in the variance equation of a GARCH model, only in the mean equation. But after we have taken, in this parametric way, we have taken care of the heteroscedasticity in the error term for that mean equation, in the UT term, then it should be the case that if the GARCH representation is valid, then the residual series from that, the normalized residual series from that should be behaving like a normally distributed variable. So that helps us in getting efficient parameter estimates for the mean equation, actually. That is one of the main things here. But in actual real life applications, you basically should take into account that it can be actually that the volatility is also stochastic. It's very much sample dependent. So there's no reason to believe that, for example, in a set of various returns, the GARTS representations would be exactly the same for each and every conditional volatility for each and every return series. So stochastic volatility models contain a second error term which enters into the conditional variance equation. But so basically this one of the examples for a stochastic volatility could be this kind of AR1 or ARP representation for the estimated volatility. So this is something that we have already been discussing. But I should actually warn you here that these kind of volatility model specifications, so basically you are taking into account that in the mean equation, yes, you have once again this volatility component here explaining the behavior of the means, and you have a specific additional equation to model the volatility behavior, but you are admitting that there is a lot of things that might actually not be captured just using this very simple parametric representation. So there's an error term here. And this error term is another normally distributed random variable that is supposed to be independent of this mean equation error term. The volatility is latent rather than observed, and so that is modeled in an indirect way, basically. So in theory, these are much, much better models to actually model the actual volatility in the markets, but they are very much more difficult to be estimated also. So they are basically based on numerical methods or numerical models for the estimation, and in practical applications we don't use these very much actually. So the next step that was taken in the development of these GARTS models was not to go towards these more mathematically or in statistical theory sense valid representations of volatility using stochastic volatility, because they are very difficult to estimate, basically. Then the next step was to start considering the usefulness of modeling of individual return series, their volatilities as a GARTS process, admitting that a specified GARTS process for one variable might not be exactly the same kind of parameters in terms of the parameter estimates for another return series. So in this case, we are considering the so-called multivariate GARTS models. So here basically the main intuition, the main need for these models is to be taking into account the time varying variances in both of these series that we are considering. For example, if we are considering a return series for a Nokia stock, we are interested about its correlation with the market returns, obviously. This comes from a simple capital asset pricing model. But there's no reason to assume that the volatility behavior would be the same in these series. But it might be the case that these volatilities from time to time, they are correlated with each other. So the detection of covariance between these return series or the variation in the return series would be something that is very relevant for you to reveal. How they develop over time. So we are now extending these univariate volatility models to a case where we have more than one return series to be discussed or analyzed. So this is very important in, for example, analysis when you want to discuss about the possibility of spillovers between different markets. For example, does the general index volatility in emerging markets does it have any kind of role to do in determining the general index volatility in developed markets? Are the Swedish stock market general index returns, is there volatility in any connection to the Finnish stock market general index return volatility? So we are talking about volatility spillovers. And this is actually highly relevant. This is the thing, or this is the main reason why I have been very much fond of these Karch models all the times. Because they, in the multivariate extension, they allow you to analyze the dependencies between the riskiness. You can analyze, obviously, the dependency of the returns or the mean returns, but also the riskiness of the markets using these multivariate Karch models. So we are interested about whether there are covariations between different markets. And so obviously in this case, we cannot use a univariate model because we have two different data series or two different return series that we're interested about. So this is actually the thing that I am interested in, these applications of Karch models the most. And these are useful, for example, in the calculation of hedge ratios, portfolio risk measures, like, for example, value at risk measures. You usually use a Karch model for the return volatility when you want to analyze value at risk estimates, capital asset pricing betas when you allow for the time variation of the capital asset pricing betas, and so on. So basically, you have to here allow that the variances of the two series are from time to time more dependent on each other than in other times. So we are talking about covariances, correlation between the returns and the variances of the individual returns. Do the level differences in the variances affect also on the correlation between these returns? So we can use these for conditional capital asset pricing models and estimation of dynamic hedge ratios and portfolio variances. And actually, at least for this part, I would very much encourage you to take a look at that chapter 9 in the Brooks book that we are using in this course, because it covers nicely also all these models. We are going through this, but in much more details. It gives you a nice description of the usability of this kind of covariance modeling, time-varying covariance modeling. Okay, so simple covariance models are just for the purposes of discussion between the historical and implied volatilities. So in exactly the same fashion as for the volatility models, historical covariance or correlation between two series can be calculated from a set of historical data. Implied covariances can be calculated using options whose payoffs are dependent on more than one underlying asset, because obviously in that case, the covariation between the underlying asset returns should be the one that is also affecting the pricing of those options. But these kind of options are actually quite rare. Usually these kind of cross market options are not very often used in the markets, not very much. So there are not very much. So the number of such options is very, very small. So basically you don't have these kind of possibilities to use similar kind of implied covariances to detect basically the or used for out-of-sample forecasting of some covariances between two assets. So these kind of examples include, there are some examples like rainbow options or crack spread options for different grades of oil and currency options. These are being discussed in the whole book that is being used in the Johannes course. So if you are interested about this, pricing of these, this naturally involves the analysis of covariances between the underlying assets, asset returns. If you are interested about these, take a look at the whole book. options, futures, and other derivatives that Johan is using in his course. And also that big book by Boudicaine and Marcus, Investments, is actually giving a very good description of these also. So basically in these kind of, what these kind of implied covariance models actually give you an idea about the things that we are now focusing here in the multivariate extension of Karch models. So for example, for currency options, actually you'd be considering two currencies, and the implied variance of the cross currency returns can be given based on this. So basically the implied variance is something that is capturing the covariance between, so x times y variance of that thing is the covariance between the x currency and y currency returns. So it's a sum of the variance of x currency returns and y currency returns minus 2 times the covariance between, or the 2 times the correlation between those things. So you have here implied variances of the x and y and returns, and this is the covariance. So 2 times correlation times standard deviation of this times standard deviation of this. So if the implied covariance, for example, for US dollar per Deutschmark, and or nowadays actually euro, and US dollar for against Japanese yen is of interest, then the implied variances of returns of the US dollar against Deutschmark and US dollar against Japanese yen, and the returns of the cross currency German mark against Japanese yen are actually required. And we are actually using an example of these kind of possibilities to use models that are based on the Karch family, for example, in our demonstrations, because we are focusing on a much more recent data set on USD values of euro, British pound, and Japanese yen, actually. And it actually gives quite interesting results in the demonstrations. So we have also other than multivariate Karch models for the modeling of the covariances between the returns. We have these so-called exponentially weighted moving average covariance models. So you can take a look at these also from the textbooks. We won't be focusing on these much, too much, but they estimate the variances and covariances at time t in a bivariate setup with two returns, x and y, and you can write the covariance between these based on simply as the function of the past values of the covariance plus 1 minus the lambda adaptation parameter on the product of returns. So you have return series x and y. So basically you can do this kind of exponential weighting moving average analysis also. But this is something that we don't be focusing too much on this course, because basically it's a bit problematic way of representing the covariance, because it's actually an indication of an integrated Karch model, which means that in the conditional variances of both these assets, you would have a unit root process. So that is actually not something that I would do very much actually take into, or too much put effort on this, because it's not actually thing that we want to have in the variances. So we don't want to have unit roots in the specified Karch representation of the conditional variance. So these are not the one. And these are the ones that we want to use. And I think that my computer is now, time is half past one. So let's now have a 15 minutes break. So let's continue from this very interesting case that is actually the relevant case for the practical applications. I will show you one of my articles also with respect to this. So let's now take a 15 minutes break. So be back here 15 to 2. Okay, so let's continue now the discussion of the GARCH models in view of the multivariate case here. So this is the case that is actually the most, perhaps even the most important applications of the GARCH models in my view, because this allows for the possibility that basically throughout the time in different observations of time, the variance of the returns of two individual or more than two individual assets might be changing, and also their correlation, the correlation between the returns might be changing. And that correlation might be actually dependent on the variances of the individual returns. So that's it. That is actually the main point in the whole of this multivariate GARCH model analysis. So I would, for those of you that are interested in digging deeper of these models, take a look at the paper by Boleslev, Engle, and Woolrich. The paper is titled Capital Asset Pricing Model Under with Time Varying with Conditional Covariances. Well, the title is something like that, but nevertheless, the paper is published in Journal of Political Economy in 1988. So it's published in one of the two top journals in economics and actually also in within the finance discipline, perhaps. But nevertheless, it's more like an economics journal. So they give all the details about the models that we are going to discuss here now. And I will only give you a short introduction to these ones to get the general idea in terms of a practical applications. So there are basically three classes of these multivariate. So multivariate here simply means that we are now analyzing more than just one return series. We have been throughout until now, we have been discussing only but one return series. Now we are extending this to a natural case of more than one. In a portfolio, we usually have more than one investment asset. So we are discussing this, and there are three main classes. The first one is the so-called VEC model, and vector of conditional heteroscedastic equities, and then diagonal VEC model, and then so-called Boleslev, Engle, Kroner application. And in more details, we are going to be going through this VEC representation and this diagonal VEC representation. So the simplest case is always the case of two assets. And in many cases, actually applications or applied papers focus on the correlations between two individual assets, either from the commodity markets or stock markets or any other financial market segments. The conditional main idea here is to model the conditional covariance matrix, and it's denoted as HT. And main thing here is now to allow that it is time varying. So we have this subscript T. So for each and every time point, this guy here changes. For the case of two assets, it would be 2 × 2 matrix. So HT and VEC HT are denoted to be these kind of guys. So here we have once again these conditional variances here in the diagonal and the conditional covariance. And we are allowing now that everything here can change over time. So up until monthly observations ending in January 2020, these H guys are different for a pair of asset returns compared to the situation, for example, in December 2019. So they are changing over time. And the main interesting part here is that allowing that these are changing, there's no reason to believe that the covariance between those would not also change. So we are focusing also very much on the off-diagonal elements of these covariance matrix H. So these H12T and H21T are actually of interest to us. But in that original representation of Bollerslev and others in Journal of Political Economy, they actually assumed that it's well, perhaps it's well sort of grounded to assume that we don't have to take into account this lower element in lower left element in this covariance metrics, because it's pretty much the same as the higher right element. So they are focusing on this stacked representation of this H matrix. So they are focusing on the vector representation. But nevertheless, we here also analyze the case that, okay, the variance of the first return or the asset return, it's changing over time. And the variance of the second asset return is also changing over time and each and every point in time, but also the covariance between those. So this cross item here, H12, refers to the time varying covariance between these two. So obviously, for example, in the applications regarding, for example, optimal hedge ratios, you can actually calculate the optimal hedge ratio if you are able to calculate the correlation between these returns and also the covariance and the variance of the returns. So at each and every point of time, you should be able to calculate also the optimal hedge ratio. So in the case of this VEC representation that was given in this Bollerslev paper, conditional variances and covariances would each depend upon lagged values of all of the variances. So this is like a VAR, kind of a VAR representation. But the VAR here actually considers now this H, or this conditional variances of each and every asset that we are considering. So they would be dependent on lagged values of all of the variances and covariances. So covariances also change for each and every point of time, as you see here. And on lags of the squares of both errors, error terms, and their cross products. So this is clearly a huge extension, but obviously from here you see that this originally is a Karch type of representation. So if you estimate a Karch model for each and every return series, and also a Karch model for the covariance of the returns, like is here the last equation. But the main thing here is now that you are not, in terms of the arch part of the Karch model in this covariance equation, you are considering the cross product of the error terms, the lagged values for the first return, mean equation for the return residual, and the second mean equation for the return that you are considering the second asset, its lagged value in the residuals. So basically, as you see, these are Karch models. This is a Karch model for the first asset's conditional volatility. This is a Karch model for the second asset's conditional volatility. And this is a Karch model for the covariance between these two guys. And it is dependent on the correlation and the variances, and also on the correlation in the residuals in the mean equation of the individual assets. And this is actually quite nice. This is very nice. This is gives you a rich structure for the dynamics or the dynamic dependence between the returns. So the diagonal VEC representation is the one that we usually use here. So here, basically, the upper diagonal representation is given here for this case in this representation. So this goes to or simplifies into a simple Karch 1-1 representation for both variances and also for a Karch 1-1 representation for the covariance. So all you need to do is to be able to estimate all these guys at each and every point of time. So you don't have to take care of these nasty looking VEC things here in your practical applications, but you have to be able to somehow interpret the results that you get from these estimations. So the Beck Boleslev Engle Kroner specification of this model actually uses a quadratic form for the parameter matrices to ensure positive definite variance covariance matrix for the overall H matrix, the overall variance covariance matrix. So these guys here are individual elements in this whole variance covariance matrix. So these guys are here at the diagonal. So they are referring to the time varying variances of individual assets. And this off diagonal element here is referring to the covariance. So the correlation between the returns is time varying here. And that is the key interesting thing here, that how do these time varying correlations change over time? And are they reacting to something other information outside this pair of assets, for example? Do the correlations, let's say, between gold market returns and stock market returns, or stock market returns for certain segments of assets like oil companies, for example, how do they correlate over time with, for example, oil market futures returns? Are they, what is the correlation over time, and how does it change, let's say, around the financial crisis periods? This is actually the main thing that we did in our paper that I'm going to be shortly presenting you at the end of this lecture. So what is a Beck, Boleslev Engle Kroner? Beck means, refers to these guys' names. What is a Beck representation? It's basically a similar kind of representation, but it actually gives you a bit different description for the covariance. Take a look at the paper by Engle and Kroner in Journal of Econometrics, to my mind, it was in Econometric Theory, actually, that gives a more detailed description of this. So in some cases, it might be useful to use this representation, but nevertheless, the idea is pretty much the same. So we are interested about the correlation between the returns. And now here, we allow the correlation to be time varying, or more importantly, to be dependent on the time variation in the variances of the individual return series. So it's obviously interesting to start from the first most simple specification for this. And we are now discussing about the constant conditional correlation models here. So the correlations between a pair of series, and series here always refers to the returns in our case, at each point in time can be constructed by dividing the conditional covariances by the product of the conditional standard deviations from a Beck or Beck model. You can use the previous models to calculate these at each and every point of time. But a different approach would be to model the dynamics for the correlations directly. So in this case, you are calculating covariances, but you would be perhaps interested about the calculation of the correlations, not so much about the covariances. So in the constant correlation case, the correlations between these disturbances in the mean equation, they are assumed to be fixed through time. So even though the conditional covariances are not fixed, they are tied to the variances. That's the main idea here. So the conditional variances in this fixed or the constant correlation model, they are identical to those of the individual univariate guard specifications. So they are not changing basically over time. They are estimated jointly here, but they are not changing over time. So basically here is once again the guard representation. We are now changing here the arch part of the... Previously, we have been using this UT, but in this literature, actually, most of the guys are using this epsilon to refer to that. This is the error term from the mean equation. So this is once again GARCH 1-1, epsilon to the power of 2. Off-diagonal elements in this constant correlation coefficient model of this variance-covariance matrix, they are defined indirectly by the correlations. So after you have calculated the correlations, you are able to calculate also the off-diagonal dimensions of the variance-covariance matrix. Is this relevant in practical applications? This is something that you can always start from, but this is basically not allowing the time variation in the correlation coefficients to be dependent on the variation of the individual variances in the returns. So to me, this is not actually empirically so very much interesting, because at least in the stock market data and also in almost all commodity markets, it's actually the case that the correlation between the individual assets in these markets, they change a lot over time, actually. And one of the huge structural breaks in these correlations, these conditional correlations, was the period of global financial crisis or the starting of the global financial crisis. So basically, there are some tests to test for this constant correlation model, whether it's relevant or not. One of those is this Pera and Kim paper, and it's in Journal of Empirical Finance, 2002. So they had developed a test for that. You'll be practicing also this in the demonstrations, but it's actually something that I'm not very much interested about personally. You can test for the constant correlation, but obviously the more interesting case is this one. It's the case for dynamic conditional correlations. And there are several possible representations for these dynamic conditional correlations. Lots of time series econometricians have been doing work on these ones, but by far the most actively used model is the one by, once again, Robert Engel, who was the first or the inventor of the GARCH models, actually. So this model was first appeared in the Journal of Business and Economic Statistics, actually, in 2002. So take a look at that journal if you're interested in the origins of this model. But nowadays, this is actually standard procedure in all the applied econometric programs, like, for example, in RATS and in R and in STATA, also in EVUS, in SAS, and all the programs, basically. So it's hugely used in this kind of dynamic analysis for the market dependencies and correlation dependencies. So it's related to the constant correlation model, but here the correlations are now allowed to vary basically from each and every point of time to the other one. So here we define the variance-covariance matrix in this way. The same H, like we modeled as a VEC representation in the previous case, is now modeled based on this kind of parameterization or partition, where D is a diagonal matrix containing the conditional standard deviations of the returns, square roots of the conditional variances from univariate GARCH models estimation on each of the n individual series. So you start from the estimation of individual GARCH models for each and every return series. And R is the conditional correlation matrix. So when you want to reveal the time varying correlation between the returns, this R here is the one that you are interested about. But it's now calculated based on conditioning information from the variances at the same time. And now you here see that actually these guys here, the conditional standard deviations, they are dependent on the past. If you estimate the GARCH 1-1 model for each return, then these D guys here, D variances or D matrices, they are dependent on the past history of the error terms in the mean equation and of the past history of the conditional variances. So H, T minus 1 in GARCH 1-1 model is relevant here. But nevertheless, these correlations are the thing that you are interested about. Conditioning the GARCH 1-1 representation for each and every return equation or return data generating process for returns, you are able to construct the estimate for the current dynamic correlation between the returns based on that GARCH representation for individual returns. So there are various possibilities for the parameterization of this conditional correlation matrix. There is also this exponential smoothing approach, but that is not the one that is usually being used because that actually introduces the problem of unit roots into the GARCH process. So that is not the one that we are interested about. One specific or possible specification was given in the Engler paper originally in 2002, and it looks like this. It's a specification in a multivariate GARCH form, but using as a standard or starting approach a variable by variable GARCH estimation for each and every return in your portfolio that you are considering. So you can give it as this kind of mathematical representation. But basically the main idea here is that the conditional symmetric positive definite covariance matrix, so the conditional covariance matrix is once again here something that is related to the errors in the individual GARCH representations for the means and also to the past observations of this variance covariance matrix. So this is a GARCH, basically kind of a GARCH representation. So this is the unconditional correlation matrix of the vector of standardized residuals. Take a look at the original Engler paper if you are more interested about this, why you end up into this kind of representation. But it's from practical point of view, it's not so important. The more important thing here is that when you calculate this Q, when you are able to estimate the Q matrix, then you are also able to estimate the conditional correlation matrix based on this covariance matrix that you estimated here based on the GARCH 1-1 representation for the individual series. So Engler proposes this GARCH type or GARCH pseudo-GARCH formulation. This is not exactly the same thing as the original GARCH representation, but you start from the estimation of GARCH 1-1 basically here once again. So you model dynamically the conditional correlation matrix and you are able to construct now the conditional, the actual matrix for the conditional correlations based on the covariance matrix, conditional covariance matrix that you are estimating in this specification. So the diag here denotes a matrix comprising the main diagonal elements of this representation, and Q star is a matrix that takes the square roots of each element in Q. So basically what you are doing here is that you are taking the covariances, the conditional covariances based on the GARCH 1-1. Divide them by the product of the appropriate standard deviations in this Q star matrix to create a matrix of correlations. So when you divide covariance between the variance or standard deviation of the first asset return times the standard deviation of the second asset, you obviously, by the definition of covariance, you get the correlation from that. Because the correlation times the standard deviation of the first one times the standard deviation of the second one gives you the covariance. So basically, you are just using the definition for the covariance here when you calculate the correlations. So after you have estimated covariances, you have estimated variances for both of these assets. They are both conditional. So they are conditional or GARCH 1 representation of the returns or the variance of the returns. Then you are able to calculate for each and every point of time you are able to calculate the correlation, dynamic conditional correlation between the returns, based on the definition of covariance, basically. This is the thing that you just basically have to remember or understand from this thing. You don't have to pay too much attention to these matrix manipulations, all these kind of things here. Take a look at the original papers that I've been referring here if you are interested about these matrix manipulations. But the main thing is that you are now able, based on Karch 1-1 representation for the original variance of the return series, you are now able to calculate the conditional variances. And then you are also able to calculate the conditional covariances for each and every point of time. So when you divide the, when you divide the covariance by the variance or the variance of an individual asset, you are able to then calculate the correlation. That's the main thing basically here. So when you do this kind of DCC model estimation, it might be difficult to estimate this in a multivariate system or simultaneous equation system. So that is the reason why Engle in this original paper already proposes a two-stage procedure where each variable is in the system is first modeled separately as a univariate Karch. And then the joint log likelihood function for these states can be constructed. So you can obviously take a joint likelihood function for each and every individual mean equation and Karch model equation estimations. It would be a sum over the number of assets that you are considering of all the individual log likelihoods. Engle has proven this also in the paper. Don't pay too much attention to this. In the second stage, the conditional likelihood is maximized with respect to any unknown parameters in the correlation matrix. And the log likelihood function is defined as this representation here. So you are once again using the maximum likelihood estimation, but now in a multivariate case. But starting from an individual Karch representation for each and every return that you are considering. But you are able to act by adding up together the log likelihoods. You are able to analyze the joint log likelihood function for these Karch representations of the returns. There is also this asymmetric multivariate Karch model case where the conditional variances and covariances are permitted to react differently to positive and negative innovations of the same magnitude. So basically, this is just a multivariate extension of these Klostenczak-Andrew-Krankel or actually originally this exponential representation of the Nelson type models. But this is basically usually used in this Klostenczak-Andrew-Krankel framework for multivariate cases. So you can obviously analyze here also the effects of negative returns, whether they have more effect now, not only in the variance or the variability of the returns, but also on the covariance. Because if they have more effect than the positive returns for the individual variances, then there's no reason to believe that they would not have also effect on the covariance. And hence also the correlation between the returns. Because they might have, and they might have actually different effects on in each individual variances, but nevertheless, if there is a leverage effect, then it's affecting negative returns are affecting more than positive returns on the volatility. So their joint effect might actually also affect on the dynamic conditional correlation. That's the simple applied point in this. So For example, Kroner and G suggest this kind of asymmetric. So this is just about taking a look at the role of asymmetric models in a multivariate case. So here's an example of applying these dynamic conditional correlation analysis. Estimate the time varying hedge ratio for FTSE stock index returns. This is taken from the Brooks book, actually. So this is a Brooks book example. I will also show an example of my own after this one. But they are taking a look at the FTSE 100 stock index. So it's a general stock index, and whether it's useful to use futures markets to hedge against the risks in this general index portfolio. So they are using daily data. I should remind you that basically, because Karch phenomenon originally has been detected to be more important in daily data than in lower frequency data, these DCC Karch models also usually are applied to daily or other quite short-term or high-frequency observations from the markets. So they analyzed this period of 1st January 1985 until 9th April of 1999. And they have several competing models for determining the optimal hedge ratio. And they basically have four cases here. So the first one is that there's no reason for using futures. So there's no hedge. You do not go to the futures markets at all. Naive hedge means that you use money exactly of the same amount to the futures contracts than you are investing to the spot markets. So basically, if you go long in spot markets, you take an equally big portion or big position in shorting the futures markets, and vice versa. If you go short in the spot markets, you take an equally big portion or equally sized amount of assets in long terms, in long position in the futures markets. So that would be a knife hedge. Obviously, if the situation in the markets changes, or the correlations between the futures markets and spot markets returns changes over time, there's no reason to assume why wouldn't it change. This is actually something that gives you losses if you use this kind of hedge. So the second possibility is to do a simple multivariate Karch modeling for two returns, and assuming a symmetric model and also alternatively an asymmetric model. This is very easy to do, for example, in modern econometric programs. You just have to choose whether you want to use leverage effects or these asymmetric models, or are you assuming that the positive returns have equally big effect on the volatility, and as do the negative returns. In both cases, they estimate the OHR optimal hedge ratio, forming a one-step ahead forecast and then computing optimal hedge ratio for the next period based on the covariance of the conditional covariance of the futures. See here refers to the spots returns, futures returns and spot returns, divided by the variance of the futures returns and putting a minus sign ahead of that. By definition, this should give you the optimal level of hedging, optimal amount of the units of futures contracts in the units of spot contracts that you want to purchase. Here are the results. The main idea is always in hedging, try to aim or get a minimum variance portfolio. So what can you say about these results here? Is it useful for you to use a dynamic DCC Karch modeling for your hedging activities? And why is it? Actually, the notions are here wrong. So this HCF, it's this HFC. So it's a covariance, conditional covariance between futures and spot returns divided by the variance of futures returns. So this gives you the optimal time varying hedge ratio. How many agreements in units of spot assets you have to buy to be able to hedge against the risk of 1% unit in the spot portfolio. So take a look at the returns of these portfolios. It's about portfolios. In unhedged case, you don't have futures at all. And these brackets here are actually, once again, T statistics. So in the case of unhedged portfolio, beta is obviously zero. You are not engaging into the future markets at all. You are just investing in spot portfolio. Is it useful to use, the first question would be that, is it useful to use knife hedge? Is there anyone anymore present? Can anyone give me an idea? Is it useful to use knife hedge?
No, it's not.
Well, can you say that based on trying to achieve the minimum variance portfolio compared to...
It lowers the variance, but...
Yeah, it lowers the variance, but you lose. As I already mentioned here, it's usually the case that if you use a knife, so you are buying exactly the same amount of futures agreements that you have the amount of spot investments there. It usually ends up into not at least very big returns. All here depends on the correlation between the returns, obviously. But here you have a not statistically significant loss either, because T statistics is very low. But the key thing here is to take a look at the variance, and the variance goes clearly lower. So if the variance goes lower, what can you say about the general correlation or the overall correlation between spot returns and futures returns? Is it positive? Is it negative? Or is it close to zero? Because this clearly gets lower, then obviously it is the case that it might be close to zero, but it might be even negative. But the main thing to take into account is that it might be time varying, actually. And when you take that into account, you are actually able to even lower the variability of your portfolio returns. So the variance goes clearly even lower here. So in sample terms, basically, it is useful to use, even though you are losing in terms of the return. So it's about decision regarding maximizing returns with the given variance or minimizing variance with the given return. It's the standard portfolio allocation decision regarding Markowitz portfolio theory. So you have to make a decision based on your preferences, what you want to have. Do you just want to minimize the risk and lose return, or do you just want to maximize the return? If you are maximizing the return, what would you choose based on these four outcomes?
The unhedged.
Yeah, you would not engage in the futures markets at all. If you are minimizing the risk, what would you choose from these, all these?
The asymmetric.
Yeah, because that gives you the lowest variance. But then in that case, you are accepting that you might not get pretty much anything in terms of the returns. You are not losing, basically, but you are not basically getting your return in annualized terms in percentage. It's 0.6, so it's not very much, actually. So that's the in-sample results. And once again, in this case, actually, in this paper, the guys were also interested about the one step ahead out of sample. So obviously, if you have these conditional variances and covariances estimated at dynamic conditional correlations for the portfolios, you can obviously also calculate the one step ahead values for the returns and variances. And they actually get the result that in terms of the one step ahead or the out of sample performance, knife hedge is once again here something that basically gives you perhaps a loss. Returns get to be even bigger if you are not using futures at all, but they are not statistically significant, but the variance gets clearly high. So this is only intuitively actually, this is fairly obvious that if your returns get higher, also the variance, if you are not engaging into hedging activities at all, the variance should be also increasing. But interestingly, in out-of-sample view, actually, this dynamic conditional correlation-based hedging behavior might be actually relevant, even though here the returns are still not statistically different from zero, but the variance gets even lower for the out-of-sample observations compared to the in-sample observations. So in terms of making a choice regarding the future performance of your portfolio, in this case, it's even more in risk minimizing point of view. It's even more useful for you to use this dynamic conditional correlation ideas and calculate the optimal hedge ratios based on this. Note that here this focus is only on the one step ahead forecasts once again. So it's on a daily basis. So basically in longer terms, it might be something that you are not so able to use or utilize in your hedging activities, because you have to remember that also in this case, the memory in the GARCH process that these guys were also using, I have not told it here, but it's actually based on GARCH 1-1 representation. So the memory is very short. So also the calculation of these dynamic conditional correlations actually utilizes the best information from the just the most recent observations for the error term in the mean equation, and also for the past conditional covariance in the variance in the GARCH equation. But nevertheless, this should give you an idea that perhaps these actually, and this is actually that raised my interest to these GARCH models. I was not a big fan of these models before Engle came up with his application in 2002. I had already finished my PhD at that time, and I was going more like towards macro applications. But after the introduction of these DCG GARCH models, I just got an idea that this really could be useful in doing these hedging strategies, for example. And I have done quite a lot of papers already utilizing these approaches. But the main here is now that if you are using this kind of modeling approach, it basically allows you to take a look at whether these time-varying hedge ratios or the underlying dynamic conditional correlations might be in connection to something else that you are not considering in your model. Basically, here you are just considering two returns. You're considering futures market returns for a relevant futures agreement, and that's the underlying asset in this case is the S&P 100 stock portfolio, or the general index. So basically, this is about correlations between two returns. What about if these correlations are actually in connection to something else? And actually, that is the thing that I want to show to you before I end these lectures. So I start sharing a new screen, And if anyone of you is interested in doing these kind of things in your thesis, I would be more than happy to supervise your work, because I'm fairly big fan of these models at the moment. And this is actually an example of a very good master's thesis. But I should warn here that Juho Pesonen was one of the one of my master's thesis students 3 years ago, and he was doing his master's thesis in 2016-17, and he ended up doing these kind of things about utilizing the DCC GARCH models. And this is actually something that you can take a look at if you're interested about this, because we have nice practical implications for cases of crude oil futures and gold futures and equity market returns. Are you able to use gold market futures, and are you able to use oil market futures for hedging possibilities against the risks in stock markets? And we are considering oil company stocks and also the general index stocks. And we are using basically, so I have highlighted here in yellow. Are you able to see this now?
Yeah.
So I have highlighted here in yellow the main things that you should sort of get a grip of this paper. Let's say something like 30-40% of the results are based on Juho's master's thesis, but the paper had to be rewritten completely, and it took almost 2 years for me and Juhani to write this in a completely new point of view. But we were actually able to, so we are using here these data series. All data has been gathered from the data stream, and so we are plotting here first the gold price series here for spot prices, and then also for crude oil, and all the data comes always from data stream, and then we are also plotting the data series for the S&P 500 and these oil market companies, but or the returns for those. But we are using this basically this Engle type DCC GARCH model here. So it's a GARCH 1-1 model. We are using DCC modeling for those conditional covariance matrices. And after we have done all the calculations, we are able to calculate the correlations. So when you save the covariance matrices and divide each and every point value of the covariance matrix with the multiplication of the variances, take a square root of those, you are able to calculate those dynamic correlations. And we did that. And then after that, we constructed the optimal hedge ratios. And we have drawn those here. There are lots of things here. Actually, this is also a nice paper to take a look at if you are figuring what to do in terms of reporting your results in your master's thesis. Take always first a look at the descriptive statistics, draw the figures, do the unit truth tests and so on, and then start doing your actual interesting things. So take a look at this paper when you start doing your master's thesis, actually. And here are the actual equations. So we made a VAR type estimation for the mean equations. And basically after that, we did a equation by equation Clausten, Jagannath and Runkel GARCH 1-1 modeling for the conditional variance. And we were able to find in some cases also some leverage effects. And for example, for the S&P 500 total returns and S&P 500 energy, it's not oil companies, it's energy companies, even also some kind of leverage effect. But perhaps not for all the cases, like for the crude oil, it was not the case that there's a leverage effect there. But nevertheless, after we took these all things, we were able to print out the dynamic correlations between the various pairs of these assets. And the thing that sort of raised our interest was that they changed a lot after global financial crisis. And you can actually use these to calculate the optimal portfolio shares of these assets also, and they change quite a lot around the financial crisis periods. So we extracted a number of financial crisis periods. You see that here also the dynamic correlation between gold futures and general index, stock market index, they actually change quite a lot. So also in here, gold market basically could be providing some kind of perhaps hedging, but they also, the correlations increase after the 2009. So basically in this case, actually here, it should not be the case that the gold market is so much able to provide hedging against or hedging advantages against the risk in stock market returns. So we plotted all these, and here is a special case for crude oil and S&P 500. It changes a lot towards even more higher positive values already before the global financial crisis. And these are the things that I'm interested in the most. I'm not just interested about the correlation between two assets. Are they in connection to something else? And these guys here are clearly in connection to global financial crisis. So basically, these kind of results should raise your interest in doing things. Basically, when you are using financial market data or commodity market data, do always the splitting of sample based on global financial crisis. Because it introduced a huge structural break basically to everything, and that is actually the reason why in also the demonstration, when you are using the most recent data, we want to always take a closer look at the period after the global financial crisis. Note that here our data is ending to 2016. Obviously COVID-19 has also introduced a new structural break. So perhaps these dynamic conditional correlations also have changed quite a lot now that we have this continuous era of unconventional monetary policy actions going on. As you see, I'm really, really excited about these things. So I'm very much interested in supervising your work if you are interested in doing something in these dynamic conditional models. Because it's a thing that is actually very, very relevant. So we calculated at the end of the day, actually the minimum variance weights of the stock market assets and gold market futures and all futures in a portfolio containing the S&P 500 total returns, for example. So we are able to do this. And you see also here basically a structural change after the Lehman Brothers crisis. So these change quite a lot. For example, for the oil market, because it suffered quite a lot from the real economic crisis, the minimum variance weights get a lot lower. So it's not optimal to have oil market assets so much in your portfolio after the global financial crisis. The situation has changed since 2012. It has even achieved higher levels of optimality in its weights, but this you can calculate after you have constructed or derived the dynamic conditional correlations. Okay, so if you are interested in doing these things, take a look at my paper. Is there just out of interest to give you an idea about the more recent studies than the ones that we have been discussing here in the lectures. Okay, then in the actual slides, I also have here, because I know that for most of you, these things, these things are actually something that can be kind of a disturbing to get a grip of when you do these or take a look at these, any kind of econometric models for the first time. Then I have here a recap of, short practical recap of the Karch models, why we are using Karch models. So after you have perhaps taken a look at these slides first, then take a recap of these last seven or something slides here in the end of this week 4 lectures. to remind you of the need for Gauge models. This is a very nice family of time series models that nowadays are being heavily used also in practical applications in the amongst the professionals in financial markets. So there's a very short recap of for the reasoning why we want to use and various representations of the models. And here I have only shortly mentioned the most recent applications, and the one that I'm mostly interested in myself is this DCC cards application of these models. Okay, I'm a bit exhausted, but I hope that you were able to get at least some kind of ideas from these. And Juha-Matti and Aleksandra will be discussing about these and presenting the practicalities or how to do these models or estimate these models in practice in the demonstrations on Monday. And next week we'll be covering the other kinds of nonlinear time series models covering the reasons for why you would be interested in modeling structural breaks in the time series processes in other than Karch family applications. So after that, I will give you the instructions on the home assignment on Friday next week. And Juha-Matti and Aleksandra will go also those through at the end of the last demonstration, so demonstration 5 on 15th of February. Does anyone have any questions at this point? No. Okay, so please try to participate as actively as possible in the next Monday's demonstration and be active in asking questions. If anything is unclear there, how to do the estimations with the models, then raise your hand there in the Zoom and ask or open the microphone and ask from the guys there. They should be familiar with all these things now that are being covered. So that's it from me now, and see you next time. Next week, Wednesday, and the time is at 12:15, also on 10th.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you.